Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens. Transform your home with the warmth of an Irish made kitchen. Cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
Eilish, thank you very much indeed. And a reminder that we will have Dr. Deirdre Lundy with us in the next little while. Deirdre is a GP and a women's health expert, and she will be here to answer your questions about menopause. We've got lots of questions in, but keep them coming because we'll have a decent amount of time with Deirdre when she's here. 51551 is the number to text. Now, though, Ukrainian forces have reportedly destroyed a second strategic bridge in Russia's Kursk region. It's almost 2 weeks now since Ukraine first launched its cross-border attack into Russian territory. In his nightly address on Sunday, the Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky revealed for the first time that the purpose of this military incursion included the creation of a buffer zone to stop Russian attacks. Well, for more on this, we're joined first by Roland Oliphant, who is senior foreign correspondent with the Telegraph newspaper, and John Everard, former British ambassador to Belarus and North Korea. And you're both welcome, and thank you for joining us this morning. So, Roland, firstly, to this second bridge that the Ukrainian forces are reported to have destroyed within a week, and they've posted a video of this. You can see the aerial view of the damage done. What can you tell us about the bridge, the significance of it, and the fact that this incursion is continuing?
Yeah, so this bridge is at a place called Zvanoya, and it is a bridge across a river called the Selin. And the significance is basically that river kind of sits on the left flank of this Ukrainian salient inside Russia. There's three usable bridges across it. The Ukrainians destroyed one last week. They say they've destroyed the second one this week. And this morning, the Russians actually confirmed the Ukrainians see it. We don't know if they've actually damaged or how badly damaged the third one. So you can see what they're trying to do. What they're trying to do is prevent the Russians from getting reinforcements across those that river to kind of protect the Ukrainian left flank. And that gives the Ukrainians two options. It's going to make it easier for them to concentrate their offensive operations on the east-facing side of that salient without, worrying too much about being attacked from behind. But it also might open the opportunity for them to seize all of that territory. You might end up seeing this river becoming a kind of a front line if the Ukrainians want to expand in that direction. Mm.
And for the Russians then, their supply routes to their troops, they've vastly reduced. I understand they only have one route now in order to get what they need into those soldiers at this stage.
Yeah, on that particular side of the salient, on the other side is another question. We're talking about the little bit that's being isolated there is probably, you'd probably end up doubling the size of the area that the Ukrainians currently occupy. On the other side, the side facing Kursk City, the side facing Belgorod, you're seeing the Russians actually bring in a lot more troops, and they're beginning to lay minefields, anti-tank defences, in an effort to slow down this Ukrainian advance. It looks like they are managing to slow it slightly. They haven't stopped the Ukrainians yet. But we think the Russians have rushed in probably somewhere in the region of 5,000 troops from various different units in an effort to contain this. They haven't contained it yet, but you can see the tempo of the Ukrainian advance beginning to slow a little bit.
Mm-hmm. And what do you make of what the Ukrainian president said last night? The reason for doing this is to create a buffer zone in the Kursk region. What does that mean, and what does that tell us about what might lie ahead?
I mean, I think I take two things from that. One is that, from the beginning of this operation, Ukrainians were extremely cagey about the specific kind of tactical objectives, like what are you going to do? And it's been clear from the beginning that there's a dilemma. Do you keep on advancing and maintaining the advantage you have of momentum? Well, if you do that, you're going to overextend, you're going to become vulnerable, your forces get surrounded, and things could quickly turn into a disaster. Are you going to pull back and retreat, in which case you preserve the lives of your men, which is really important for Ukraine? They cannot afford casualties in the way that the Russians can. Or are you going to stay put? And this suggests they're going to stay put. When you talk about buffer zone, that means you're holding ground. So I think the Ukrainians are going to try and dig in, they're going to try and stay put, and they're going to try and, they're basically going to dare the Russians to, come and push us out if you really want to. And the second thing, when we talk about a buffer zone, I mean, it's a... we're talking about the Ukrainians hold,
an area about 20 to 30 kilometres deep, about 50 kilometres across as the crow flies, right? Given the size of the Russian border with Ukraine, you know, that doesn't create that much of a buffer except for a very small part of the border. But I think what it does do, it'll do two things. First of all, it will create, you know, a problem for the Russians. They're going to have to devote more troops. If they want to launch a counteroffensive to get them out, it will take a lot more resources than they've committed so far. And hopefully that will take pressure off other parts of the Ukrainian front. But the other thing is, you know, the Ukrainians and the Russians both have their kind of eye on the negotiating table. However, you know, whether it's this year, whether it's next year or the year after that, and you can see them kind of trying to create facts on the ground so that when they get there, they will be going in with the strongest set of cards to play. And I think this is very much about creating, you know, putting a very good card in Ukraine's hand for if and when they end up sitting down to hammer out some kind of ceasefire.
Okay, well, that's a good point to bring John Everard in on. Do you think that that is perhaps what this is about, looking ahead to negotiations, and that Ukraine now would have a stronger hand when that moment comes?
Well, yes, Claire. We don't need to speculate. The Ukrainians have said this, that they want to force the Russians into negotiations, and of course they want to strengthen their hand. I'm sure that in that they have an eye on the November elections in the United States, and they're hedging against the possibility of Donald Trump return to power, in which case continued US assistance to Ukraine cannot be taken for granted.
Mm-hmm. And do you think that it creates an immediate problem for the Russians with the distraction, the need to deploy troops into this area, that might also be a factor at play when you think about the Ukrainian strategy in doing this?
Yes, I'm sure that is also a factor. I mean, the Russian advance towards Pokrovsk in the Donbass area continues. It's a crawl. It's very slow, but they are actually still moving forward. So if the Ukrainian objective was to halt that advance, that hasn't yet worked. It might yet work in future if the Russians feel they have to throw the Ukrainians out, whereas we were just saying, they would need to commit a lot more troops to destroying the Ukrainian salient that the advance has just created. I think, too, there are other objectives. Firstly, they wanted to unsettle Putin. They wanted to do something that Putin was not expecting. And in that, they've clearly succeeded. Putin is rattled. The other was to take prisoners. And the Ukrainians have said that already the Russians have approached them to ask for a prisoner swap. They've got a lot of Ukrainian prisoners that the Ukrainians want back. So that was part of the play also. Final point on this, they demonstrated that they can cross the border into Russia. Now, obviously, this operation was very carefully planned a long time ago. But if they can cross at this point, then if they can summon the resources and the men, they can cross at other points. And Putin must now be wondering what he's seeing is the first in a series of Ukrainian transborder crossings. That really would give him a headache.
Mm-hmm. Do you agree, Roland, that this has unsettled Vladimir Putin? I was watching a BBC report from Steve Rosenberg at the weekend, where he was in a village and people were expressing absolute steadfast support for Vladimir Putin. And it seemed to, further convince them that his strategy in all of this was the right one. And they believe that he would deal with this in a way that would settle it. Do you think, though, that, and do you agree with John, that this has really unsettled him?
I'm sure it has unsettled him. I'm sure it was, you know, it was not something they're expecting. His military failed to anticipate it and failed to prevent it. It's annoying, clearly, and you can kind of tell because, you know, Russian television and then the Kremlin are kind of referring to things like the events in the Kursk Oblast or things like that. They're not naming this thing. They're speaking in euphemisms. And it's kind of a thing you kind of get used to if you followed the Kremlin long enough. They kind of fall into that habit when something really annoying has happened. You know, Vladimir Putin famously wouldn't name Alexei Navalny, for example. So I think, yes, unsettled. That's a long way from kind of generating the kind of instability or public discontent that might bring down this regime or something. I think you should be careful about that distinction. I mean, the report you're referring to by Steve Rosenberg, that illustrates that point quite well. And I mean, this is an old hackneyed point But it's worth making. There is this old kind of saying about you know, Russia. It's about the dynamic of a good Tsar and bad boyars. So, like, the king is very good. If only he knew that, you know, how bad things were, he would fix things. The problem is all the people around him. And the Kremlin has, for 20 years, really, really played up on that dynamic. So It's not very surprising to see the Russian public saying this is bad, so on and so forth. But I'm sure Vladimir Putin will get us out of it, because that is the thing that's been hammered home for decades now.
Thank you both, Roland Oliphant and George Everard. And Dr. Deirdre Lundy will be with us next.